Preface. This book is the second of two volumes examining a daring question: whether there is a case to be made that Jesus never really existed as a historical person. The alternative is that the Jesus we know originated as a mythical character in tales symbolically narrating the salvific acts of a divine being who never walked the earth and probably never existed at all. Later, this myth was mistaken for history, or deliberately repackaged that way, and then embellished over time. Though I shall argue it's likely this alternative is true and that Jesus did not, in fact, exist, I cannot assume it has been conclusively proved here. In fact, it may yet be proved false in future work, using the very methods I employ, which were proposed and defended in my previous volume, Proving History, Bayes' Theorem, and the Quest for the Historical Jesus. Hence, the point of this book is not to end the debate, but to demonstrate that scholars need to take this hypothesis more seriously before dismissing it out of hand, and that they need much better arguments against it than they've heretofore deployed. A better refutation is needed, and a better theory of historicity, which actually, credibly, explains all the oddities in the evidence. If this book inspires nothing else, I'll be happy if it's that. But this book may do more. It might inspire more experts to agree with the possibility, at least, that Jesus Christ was born in myth, not history. And their continuing examination of the case may yet result in a growing consensus against the grain of current assumptions. Either outcome would satisfy me, for my biases are such as to make no difference what the result should be. I only want the truth to be settled. Nevertheless, all historians have biases, and only sound methods will prevent those from too greatly affecting our essential results. No progress in historical knowledge, in fact, no historical knowledge at all, would be possible without such methods. Hence, my previous volume developed a formal historical method for approaching this or any other debate, which will produce as objectively credible a conclusion as any honest historian can reach. One need merely plug all the evidence into that method to get a result. However, because this volume can't address every single item of evidence, it merely addresses the best evidence there is, its conclusion may yet be brought down, even with its own method, simply by introducing something it omits. If so, I welcome it. Though I already discussed my biases and background, and the origin of this project, in the preface to Proving History, for the reader's convenience I shall repeat that here. I am a marginally renowned atheist, known across America and many other corners of the world as an avid defender of a naturalist worldview and a dedicated opponent of the abuse of history in the service of supernaturalist creeds. I am a historian by training and trade. I received my PhD in ancient history from Columbia University, and a philosopher by experience and practice. I have published peer-reviewed articles in the field and am most widely known for my book on the subject, Sense and Goodness Without God, A Defense of Metaphysical Naturalism. I have always assumed without worry that Jesus was just a guy, another merely human founder of an entirely natural religion, whatever embellishments to his cult and story may have followed. I'd be content if I were merely reassured of that fact, for the evidence, even at its best, supports no more startling a conclusion. So I have no vested interest in proving Jesus didn't exist. It makes no difference to me if he did. I suspect he might not have, but then that's a question that requires a rigorous and thorough examination of the evidence before it can be confidently declared. Most secular scholars agree. Even when they believe Jesus existed, they do not need to believe that. Believers, by contrast, and their apologists in the scholarly community cannot say the same. For them, if Jesus didn't exist, then their entire worldview topples. The things they believe in, and need to believe in, more than anything else in the world will then be under dire threat. It would be hard to expect them ever to overcome this bias, which makes bias a greater problem for them than for me. They need Jesus to be real, but I don't need Jesus to be a myth. Most atheists agree, and yet so much dubious argument has appeared on both sides of this debate, including argument of such a technical and erudite character that laypeople can't decide whom to trust, that a considerable number of atheists approached me with a request to evaluate the arguments on both sides and tell them whose side has the greater merit or whether we can even decide between them on the scanty evidence we have. That's how my involvement in this matter began, resulting in my mostly but not solely positive review of Erhel Doherty's The Jesus Puzzle. My continued work on the question has now culminated in over 40 philanthropists, some of them Christians, donating a collective total of $20,000 for Atheists United, a major American educational charity, to support my research and writing of a series of books in the hopes of giving both laypeople and experts a serious evaluation of the evidence they can use to decide who is more probably right. The first step in that process was to assess the methods so far employed on the subject and replace them if faulty. I accomplished that in the previous volume, in which I demonstrated that the most recent method of using historicity criteria in the study of Jesus has been either logically invalid or factually incorrect, and that only arguments structured according to Bayes' theorem have any chance of being valid and sound. Here I apply that method to the evidence for Jesus and show what results. Though this is a work of careful scholarship, the nature of its aims and funding necessitate a style that is approachable to both experts and laypeople. By the requirements of my grant, I am writing as much for my benefactors as my fellow scholars. But there is a more fundamental reason for my frequent use of contractions, slang, verbs in the first person, and other supposed taboos. It's how I believe historians should speak and write. Historians have an obligation to reach wider audiences with a style more attractive and intelligible to ordinary people, and they can do so without sacrificing rigor or accuracy. Indeed, more so than any other science, history can be written in ordinary language without excess of reliance on specialized vocabulary, though we do need some, and without need of any stuffy protocols of language that don't serve a legitimate purpose. As long as what we write is grammatically correct, accurate, and clear, and conforms to spoken English, it should satisfy all the aims of history: to educate and inform and advance the field of knowledge. This very book, just like the last, has been written to exemplify and hopefully prove that point. The support I received for this work has been very generous. As before, I must thank Atheists United for all their aid and assistance, and all those individual donors who gave so much and for little in return but an honest report. No one, not even Atheists United, who provided me with the financial grant and aid, nor any donor to that fund, was given any power to edit or censor the content of this work or to compel any particular result. They all gave me complete academic freedom. That also means I alone am responsible for everything I write. Atheists United wanted to see what I came up with and trusted me to do good work on the strength of my reputation and qualifications, but they do not necessarily agree with or endorse anything I say or argue. The same follows for any individual donors. More particular thanks are in order for them, who made this work possible. Benefactors came not only from all over the United States, but from all over the world, from Australia and Hong Kong to Norway and the Netherlands, even Poland and France. Not all wanted to be thanked by name, but of those who did or didn't object, my greatest gratitude goes to the most generous contributors: Jeremy A. Christian, Paul Doland, Dr. Evan Fales, Brian Fleming, Scott and Kate Jensen, Fab Lishka, and most generous of all, Michelle Ree and Maciek Kojojejczyk. Next in line are those who also gave very generously, including Aaron Adair, John and Susan Baker, Robert A. Bosak Jr., John Corteliu, Valerie Mills Daly, Brian Dewhurst, Kareem Gontus, Frank O. Glomset, Paul Hatchman, Jim Lepard, Ryan Miller, Dr. Edwin Newman, Lillian Painter, Benjamin Schult, Vern Shepard, Chris Stoffel, James Tracy, Stuart Turner, Keith Warner, Jonathan Whitmore, Dr. Alexander D. Young, Frank Zindler, and Damian Zoer. But I am grateful even for the small donors, whose gifts collectively added up to quite a lot, including the generosity of David F. Browning, David Empey, Landon Hedrick, Gordon McCormick, and many others. This book would never have been written without all their support. Many even provided valuable advice toward improving it. It is very rewarding to present this book, as I did the last, to those who respect and enjoy my work enough to keep me employed just to educate themselves and the public about what many consider an obscure issue, and above all, who have patiently waited so long for the payoff. Special thanks also go to David Fitzgerald, author of The Mormons and Nailed: 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All, for his help, advice, and friendship, and to Earl Doherty, author of The Jesus Puzzle and Jesus Neither God Nor Man, and even Evan Fales, who may one day come out with Reading Sacred Texts: An Anthropological Approach to the Gospel of St. Matthew, for their particular assistance and perspective. I don't always agree with them, but their often brilliant work did influence me, even if not always in the direction they may have hoped.